Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much, Candace, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Workshop, Emerging Treatments for Metastatic Melanoma, and this is part two of a three-part series on living with advanced skin cancer. Now, today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many cancer organizations, as well as melanoma organizations as well, Melanoma International Foundation, Melanoma Research Foundation, and the Richard David Kahn Melanoma Foundation as well, and all the other cancer organizations as well. And they've all helped to spread the word about the program, in addition to all of your great interest in the program as well. And so we have on the program today over 574 participants. You come from all of the United States, and we have international participants from Canada, India, and the United Kingdom. So it's really a credit to each of you that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us. Now, today's program is supported by grant from Genentech and Novartis Oncology, and I really want to thank them for their support of really this entire series, this three-part series, and their corporate collaboration in making this possible. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Hussein Tabi, and Dr. Tabi is Associate Professor, Director of Melanoma Clinical Research and Early Drug Development, Melanoma Medical Oncology, Investigational Cancer Therapeutics, University of Texas, MD Anderson Cancer Center. Dr. Tabi is going to present an overview of metastatic melanoma, diagnosing and staging, current standard of care, new treatment approaches, including targeted therapy, and the role of precision medicine. It's really my great pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Tabi.
Thank you so much, Carolyn, and thank you for organizing this event. I would like to start by welcoming everyone for joining us this afternoon. I think it's afternoon in Houston, might be already evening in the UK, but really glad to be here with my colleague, Dr. Luke, and looking forward to discussing with you the emerging treatments of metastatic melanoma. Just to kind of give you an overview and a framework for some of those treatments, I think it will be relevant to discuss briefly the diagnosis of and staging of melanoma. And this will really help you understand where we apply some of our treatments that have emerged in the last few years. And myself and Dr. Luke will be directing you towards some of the advances that are coming along in the next few years as well. So starting off, I just want to focus this discussion around cutaneous melanoma, melanoma that arises in the skin, since, as you know, that's the vast majority of all melanomas. Obviously, melanoma can arise in other areas, such as mucosal melanomas or sometimes even in the eye, which is called uveal melanoma. Again, those are very specific cases that our discussion may or may not apply to today. So in terms of cutaneous melanoma that arises in the skin, this is most of the time diagnosed by a dermatologist or a primary care physician. It tends to come to the attention of those physicians during skin checks and yearly checkups, but also it is common for patients and their families to note abnormal pigmented lesions on their skins and on their skin and point it out to those physicians as well. The suspicion is obviously the most important step here that leads to further medical evaluation. Usually the next step is a biopsy of a suspicious spot. As a matter of concept, I think it's very important that this first biopsy, it is highly recommended to be performed using a punch biopsy. As you know, other skin conditions can arise, and sometimes biopsies such as a shave biopsy can be performed. Those may not give the full diagnosis and the full understanding of the tumor. The thickness of the first melanoma or of the tumor in the skin actually happens to be one of the most important determinants of the potential for spread, or what we call the metastatic potential. So even a thin melanoma that is less than 1 millimeter still has a potential to metastasize or to progress to other parts of the body, although thankfully that risk is relatively low if it's less than 1 millimeter and it's less than 10%. However, a melanoma that's as thick only as 4 millimeters or that is ulcerated could already have a risk of up to 40 to 50% of metastasizing. The second most important determinant of the potential for spread is whether the local or regional lymph nodes are involved. So as an example, if a melanoma arises on, say, the upper extremity on an arm or a shoulder, you would expect that next station where the melanoma can go to is actually in the lymph nodes that are housed in the axilla or the underarm. So assessment of that location is the next step in trying to stage this melanoma and understanding whether it has already spread there. The detection of microscopic cells in those lymph nodes with a procedure called sentinel lymph node biopsy is very important. Those lymph nodes are taken to the pathology lab after surgery, and they're actually assessed microscopically to determine if there are any melanoma cells in there. And the presence of microscopic cells there can be indicative of a higher risk of metastatic spread. Now, our program today is focused on metastatic melanoma, and I really wanted to spend those few minutes discussing this issue because sometimes when you read your pathology report from even a sentinel lymph node biopsy, you will read the word metastatic melanoma. That could be referring just to the fact that those melanoma cells are in the lymph node, but it's truly not considered to be metastatic melanoma to the rest of the body until it involves other distant organs like the lung, the liver, sometimes the skin, and other areas of the body. So that's an important distinction. Not every time you see the metastatic melanoma in a pathology report that necessarily means that your melanoma has spread to the rest of the body. This could be still localized to the regional area and to the lymph node in that area. Having said that, again, the next level of staging is if we go past the lymph node, we assess the rest of the body, usually using CAT scans, looking at the chest, abdomen, and pelvis. If we detect melanoma in any region that's outside of the local area where it started, that's what's called metastatic melanoma. It's important you understand that not all metastatic disease is the same. Every time that we detect a melanoma in, again, lung, liver, or brain, that's called stage 4 disease. However, we also think about melanoma that's metastatic on the basis of the fact that it used the blood to spread to where it is. And within metastatic melanoma, there are different classifications. Simply, if the melanoma is limited to skin or lymph nodes, that's called M1A disease. If it's limited to lungs, that's called M1B disease. If it involves other visceral organs or the brain, it's called M1C disease. At the time of diagnosis of metastatic melanoma, assessing the entire body is very important. So as I said, either CAT scans, some people may use PET CTs. Those are useful as well to detect melanoma in other parts of the body. But one very important imaging assessment for patients with metastatic melanoma is assessment of the brain. And that is usually performed using magnetic resonance imaging, or MRIs. Those are essential to be able to tell us if melanoma has spread to the brain. So again, in the case of metastatic melanoma, we think about what are the determinants that this disease has spread to the brain. what other organs has it involved, and we check one blood test that helps us also understand how aggressive this melanoma is. And that blood test is called LDH, or lactate dehydrogenase. Blood levels of LDH, and I can tell you as a melanoma expert, and Dr. Luke would agree, we don't fully understand why this particular blood test really correlates with melanoma outcome, but we actually know that patients that have lower levels or normal levels of this blood test may actually do better with certain therapies. So again, it's an important determinant of where we classify your metastatic melanoma. Now, this is, again, an overview of the diagnosis and the staging. Once we determine these factors, the next step is to determine what the best therapy is. As you know, melanoma remains a very challenging disease to treat. However, the treatment options in the last 5 to 10 years have seen a period of amazing growth and progress. When I personally started treating melanoma patients all the way in 2003, we had very, very limited treatment options. In fact, in the 3 decades preceding that entire era, we only had 2 drugs that were available, and those drugs were marginal in their benefit, and they really only benefited a small percentage of patients. In the last 5 to 10 years, we have been really fortunate in this disease, and our patients have benefited from a lot of progress, and now we have up to 12 different treatment and combination therapies that have been approved in the last 5 years. This is a time of truly huge excitement and tremendous progress, and the hope is really to try to share with you today what we can do for patients today and kind of set the stage of to what we are trying to do for patients in the future as well. So currently, treatments for melanoma have improved survival, they have improved symptom control, and frankly just give us all a sense that we really are gaining so much grounds against this disease. Now, most of these advancements have happened with very well-conducted clinical research in the setting of clinical trials that have been designed well, conducted well, and led to results that were indisputable that tell us that those treatments are effective for patients with melanoma, to the point that the FDA and other regulatory agencies have approved these medicines. So I'll be telling you today about those approved medicines, and Dr. Luke as well will go over the value of clinical trials that really have been the bedrock on which we built this progress. So when we think about treatment options for metastatic melanoma, we generally classify them into 2 broad categories. We think about immunotherapy, which are treatments that utilize your own immune system to target melanoma, and we think about targeted therapies, which are generally pills that are designed to attack specific signaling pathways within the cancer cell and can help us shrink tumors. So both of those approaches have been proven effective, and we have drugs that help us achieve good outcomes in those patients. I will briefly mention immunotherapy, and Dr. Luke will expand very much on that, and then I'll spend the rest of my time speaking more specifically about targeted therapy. So immunotherapy at this point is mostly in the form of intravenous infusions. The drug names are designed to be really long and complicated, but they mostly end with the 3 letters MAB, M-A-B, which really stands for monoclonal antibodies. And you will probably have heard already and will hear about drugs, 3 important drugs. One is called ipilimumab, one is called pembrolizumab, and the 3rd one is called nivolumab. Those drugs have made tremendous impact in terms of single agents and combination therapy, and they're also called checkpoint inhibitors. They, again, use our immune system to unleash the T cells, the soldiers of the immune system, to go and attack the cancer and eliminate it. Again, Dr. Luke will expand on how those drugs are used, but essentially they're used for the most part as the first line of therapy for patients with metastatic melanoma. Targeted therapy is usually with the use of pills that are called small molecule inhibitors, and those again target the inner workings of the cancer cell, the signaling pathways that the cancer cell kind of hijacks so that it starts growing and proliferating and evades dying and evades the immune system through them. Those drugs are typically pills, and their names are also long and complicated, and they typically end with the letters ENIB or ENIB, which really implies that they're inhibitors of certain proteins called kinases. Now, this is as nerdy as this is going to go, because from here onwards, I want to tell you more specifically about how these specific drugs help patients with specific mutations in their tumor. Patients with melanoma, about half of them will have a mutation in a specific gene called the BRAF, B-R-A-F. That's about, again, half of all of those patients. And for those patients that have that mutation in the tumor, there are two combination therapies that are FDA approved. One is called the brafenib in combination with trametinib, or otherwise known as Tafinlar and Mekinist. And the other one is called vemurafenib plus cobimetinib, or Zelboraf and Cotelic. Now, why are these combinations important? Because when you treat patients with them, we get almost immediate responses. These are drugs that are taken as pills. Again, some of them are taken twice a day, some of them are once a day. And we get shrinkage of tumor in 80 to 90% of patients. So 80 to 90% of the patients that receive that therapy will have their tumors shrink. And about two-thirds of the time, or about 67% of the time, that shrinkage is significant, meaning more than 30% of the tumor burden, or sometimes up to 100%, may disappear with these drugs, which is really, really impressive and helps patients, especially if their tumors are causing pain, discomfort, or direct symptoms, because this response can happen in the course of days or weeks. Those drugs have been proven to improve survival. And now we know with long-term follow-up that around 22% of patients may actually continue to benefit from them at 3 years or longer. The main limitation of these drugs is that the response that we see, while very dramatic and makes patients feel very well pretty quickly, unfortunately may be limited in time. And you know, the expectation is that at some point in the treatment of those patients, we have to be vigilant that the tumor may actually start growing again. This will be somewhat in contrast to what Dr. Luke will share with you, because immunotherapy outcomes tend to be more durable in their effect. With that in mind, I think that's why I wanted to go over what we call currently the standard of care. We do know that we can benefit patients with BRAF-mutated melanoma with these drugs. However, it's not clear at this point whether we should start with immunotherapy or we should start with targeted therapy. And at this point, this remains an unanswered question that really will require clinical trials to give us a better sense of it. I was asked to go over precision medicine as well. I did want to share with you that at this point in melanoma, really the most important determinant of using these drugs that I just discussed is whether the BRAF mutation is present or not. There are other mutations known to be present in patients and tumors with melanoma, namely the NRAS mutation, NF1 mutation. And now that we have become much better at sequencing DNA, we can actually discover other mutations that are available or present in the tumor, it's important for you to know that at this particular moment in time, that information is still not useful in terms of telling us which treatments to choose. We currently do not have FDA-approved treatments for NRAS-mutated melanoma or other mutations, although some of the work is ongoing to try to find better treatments for those patients. So with that, I'm going to pass it along to Dr. Luke. I think I kind of tried to highlight for you what are the current treatments that are available for targeted therapy and immunotherapy, how we use precision medicine. And again, it's very important that you know that we've made huge progress in the last few years, but that some very important questions remain, as you heard, in terms of where to use our treatments, which one to start with, or whether we should combine them. And we can only arrive to those conclusions through clinical trials, and Dr. Luke will be expanding on that aspect.
No, thank you very much, Dr. Tabi. That was very excellent, very comprehensive, and really a lot of wonderful information that people have received from you. And I know there will be questions for you during the Q&A. And I do remind people that there will be a Q&A section here, and so be sure to kind of write down your questions now so that we'll be sure to get to all your questions when we are asking you for questions. So thank you very much. That was excellent. And our next speaker is Dr. Jason Luke. Dr. Luke is Assistant Professor of Medicine, Melanoma and Developmental Therapeutics Clinics, University of Chicago Medicine. And Dr. Luke is going to address the role of immunotherapy in clinical trials, follow-up care, tips for caring for your skin during cancer treatments, symptom and pain management, and discussing quality of life concerns with your healthcare team. It's now my pleasure to turn this program over to Dr. Luke.
Well, thanks so much for the invitation, and I really appreciate the opportunity to be able to speak today to this audience. I think that was definitely an excellent overview and a good segue to what I'm going to be speaking about today. And as was just mentioned, I'm going to sort of take the ball from Dr. Tabi and sort of talk a little bit more in depth about immune system treatments or immunotherapy for melanoma. So I'm going to take a step back and just starting to talk about that and make an observation that it's been known for many decades, actually, that the immune system interacts with melanoma. And people may not have recognized that in their own lives, but probably most of you know that already. You probably know someone who's got white spots on their skin or what we call vitiligo. And that's an example of where the immune system can observe that melanocytes, or the cells that become melanoma, can get messed up and can actually get rid of them. And so for a long time, because melanoma did not do well with chemotherapy, there's been an interest in developing these immune system treatments. And if we go back a few decades, and I review this history because for anyone that has a family member or that themselves have melanoma, you might go online and find these different names of drugs, and it's important to know what they are. A couple decades ago, it was recognized that certain molecules in the immune system were really essential for allowing the immune system to talk to each other, talk to itself. And those molecules are called cytokines. And they eventually came forward as drugs in the form of one drug called interferon alpha. And that's a drug that we no longer give for metastatic melanoma, but sometimes is occasionally given after surgery to try to keep melanoma from coming back. And the next step then was the identification of a molecule called interleukin-2. And that's, a cytokine molecule that helps your T cells or your cells in your body that do things to fight cancer to be more active. And so before 2011, treatment with interleukin-2 was considered a standard of care. Well, it's still a standard of care, but was very common for any patient who could tolerate it. And about 10% of patients who got interleukin-2 would have long-term survival. And that was really different than chemotherapy. And that was, again, sort of kept hope alive that immunotherapy could work for melanoma. The problem was it was very much toxic, meaning patients had a lot of side effects, and they had to be treated in the hospital, perhaps even in an ICU, due to the side effects. But again, 10% of patients did very well with that treatment, and it really kept hope alive. Until the early to mid-2000s, and eventually at 2011, when it really had a major breakthrough in the development of immunotherapy for melanoma, and it heralded the immunotherapy revolution now affecting all of cancer treatment, and that was the development of the CTLA-4 blocking antibody called ipilimumab. And you heard that mentioned earlier. That drug is also sometimes called Yervoy in the lay sort of setting. And that drug is really more of a targeted version of immune system treatment because the CTLA-4 drug, the CTLA-4 molecule, in fact, is one of the molecules that helps to turn off your natural immune system. So by developing a drug against it, you turn the off switch off, and therefore we hope that the immune system will be more on. And what's been observed is that about 20% of patients who get that drug have long-term benefit from the drug, meaning they only get four doses, but the melanoma seems to never grow again. And again, that's a big improvement. Again, we've moved from 10% to 20%. But now if we keep moving, over the last several years, there's been identification of other putative immune switches or immune molecules that have become very important. And one of them is called programmed death ligand 1 or programmed death receptor 1. And it's not so much important to remember that. This is sometimes called PD-L1 or PD-1. But these are actually switches that are in the tumor, meaning that your immune cells have found the cancer, but they get shut off actively by the tumor through expression of these immune molecules. And so now recognizing that, that gave us a clear opportunity to develop drugs there. And drugs, in fact, have been developed there that have really revolutionized melanoma treatment as well as other cancers. And so they were named earlier as pembrolizumab or Keytruda, as well as nivolumab or Opdivo. And you'll be aware that Jimmy Carter, the former president, had metastatic melanoma. And as part of his treatment, he had pembrolizumab, and he's doing very well at this point. Obviously, that's only one case, and the treatments don't work for everyone, but it really gives us hope that we can expand this benefit to more patients. So really, in the current time, when we're thinking about immunotherapy, the standard of care, at least at first, if the choice is immune therapy versus targeted therapy, is to use these PD-1 blocking antibodies either alone or in combination with ipilimumab. In other words, combining multiple immune therapies together. Now, a dispute in the field is whether or not we should give one drug versus two together. And that's really a nuanced conversation because you do get more benefit from combining two drugs together, but you get a lot more side effects. And so for any individual patient, it's important to have that conversation with your provider in terms of which would be the best for you if you choose immunotherapy. Even further, we're doing a lot more research around other ways to use the immune system as well, and that led a couple of years ago to the approval of a novel new drug, in fact, a modified virus that we inject into tumors to try to get the immune system to be more active to fight the cancer. And that molecule has a truly crazy name known as telamagine-Laher-Parepvec, or T-VEC. And the role of T-VEC is not entirely clear yet, but we think that in the future it will become more and more important that we, in fact, try to inject the tumors with virus or other sorts of molecules to amplify the immune response so that we can use the other drugs that we already know are effective that I just mentioned. Finally, in this space, I do want to mention a further sort of therapy known as adoptive cellular therapy. And that sounds very confusing, but simplistically speaking, I mentioned that some of the immune cells can find the cancer. And so for a long time, doctors have wondered if we could actually cut the tumor out and get those immune cells and then sort of buff them up in the lab, could we give them back to patients, and what would happen? And in fact, at the National Cancer Institute, at the MD Anderson, and a few other places, this is being tried to some degree of success. For individual patients, there are some who have done very, very well with this, such that many doctors hope that into the future, this may also be an approach that's more widely available for patients. So all of that is really thinking about where we're at now. And from there, I want to transition to a discussion about where do we need to go? Because we have these great new drugs, and they're on TV all the time, and everyone is excited about immunotherapy. But in fact, unfortunately, you know, we haven't cured every patient with melanoma or every other cancer, right? And so we really need to think of how are we going to make our treatments better. So in that space, we need to talk about clinical trials, which is the extension of research into standard medical practice. And so for a lot of people, when they hear about clinical trials, they immediately sort of get suspect. They're like, well, wait a minute, isn't that a research experiment? And in fact, yes, it is a research experiment, except it's an experiment to try to figure out what would be the best treatment for a patient for patients. And so when it's important then to understand what the goals are of the research and whether or not it would make sense as a good option for an individual person. So to that extent, when we talk about clinical trials, most commonly people are aware of what are referred to as phase 3 clinical trials. And these are often very big studies where patients can often be randomized to either this treatment or that treatment, and they usually don't get to pick. But the idea then is it's thought that perhaps the treatments could be equivalent. We have to figure out which one would be better. You may have heard of placebos, and that's the most common sort of form of use of placebo, though I would note that the use of placebo is relatively infrequent in cancer treatment anymore, and generally speaking is not something that people should be overly concerned about. they should definitely talk with their provider about it, but it should not really be the thing that would say yes or no, I would be willing to participate in the trial. So that's a phase three trial. In phase three trials, after the result is back, if the trial is successful, often that leads to drugs getting approved by the FDA. Before we do phase three trials, we do phase two trials, and those are smaller clinical trials in which we take a drug or some sort of approach, and we give it to a certain number of patients with the idea that if we see a signal that it looks pretty good, we might be willing to invest the resources then to go to that big phase three trial. And before we do phase two trials, we do phase one trials. And historically, phase one trials were really safety trials, meaning we would take new drugs from the laboratory and say, well, we think this might be an effective cancer drug. How are we going to give it to people? And in those trials, we would test out what is the safe dose and how often to give that drug to patients so that we could get a unified standard so we could then go forward and do phase two and phase three trials. It's important to point out, however, that the role of clinical trials and specifically phase one clinical trials has changed quite dramatically over the last 5 years, however. So it really is not so much the case anymore that phase one trials are only about safety testing. And I think this is an essential message that patients need to hear, because there's an idea out there that people would prefer to go on a phase three trial than a phase one trial. And while that could be correct, it's not necessarily correct. Because especially in the area of immunotherapy, what we've observed is that most of the time these drugs tend to be pretty safe. And so we often go through the safety portion of the testing very quickly and get thereafter into what we refer to as expansion of a phase one trial. And for all intents and purposes, that ends up being very similar to the phase two trials that I talked about before. And the reason that I raise this is that it's now the case that drug development, especially in melanoma, is moving so fast that often patients will do clinical trials in phase one, and if the results look good, we'll go straight to a phase three trial. And so it's important that patients be aware of that so as not to limit the options of what they might be willing to consider participation in. Now, obviously, the requirements in terms of what the patient needs to do to participate are different throughout these different phases. And sometimes in the phase one trials, there is more required of patients in terms of time and effort, blood tests, et cetera, et cetera. And that certainly will inform whether or not people feel comfortable to participate. But I can't emphasize enough the need for patients to continue to participate in all phases of clinical trials, because we have to continue to move the field forward, and we really don't know when the next major breakthrough is going to come through. I'll make the note that the drug pembrolizumab, or Keytruda, in fact, started in a phase one trial and moved, actually almost got approved by the FDA before the phase three trial was even performed because the results were so good. In fact, that sort of changed the paradigm where almost 600 patients were treated in the phase one trial, really suggesting that patients should really consider what the best option is in discussion with their doctor throughout all these phases of clinical trials. So clinical trial participation is really essential. We could not have made the kind of progress that's happened in melanoma. I think it's fair to say that melanoma is now at the tip of the spear, leading all of cancer research in terms of the targeted therapies that you heard about before, as well as these immunotherapies into the future. And we have many options that are available, but it's really just not good enough yet because we don't help every single patient. To that extent, then, I want to talk about the particulars of what actually happens during treatment and how can we think about optimizing that for individual patients. So in regards to the ideas of sort of follow-up or for caring for yourself during treatment, you know, it's commonly the case as you're getting these drugs that you'll have periodic visits with the physician. So while getting immune therapy, because it's an IV infusion most commonly, you're usually there every 2 or 3 weeks, and so that makes it easier for follow-up to see someone to let them know if there's a problem. With the oral medicines, the targeted therapies, however, sometimes it's a little bit longer in the time that you see the patient, and so I think it's very important that after each visit, patients and their families have a very clear sense of the methods of communication back to the doctor's office and a very clear idea about when the next visit will be and how we'll know about communicating that interim. I find that most of the time when issues arise, it's really about a miscommunication where, you know, a patient or a family thought something was going to happen and the doctor's office thought something else. And that's really where we want to make sure that there's a clear communication so we optimize patients' care. In terms of taking care of yourself during treatment, we sometimes think about the skin, particularly in the context of these drugs, since melanoma is from the skin. But in reality, we have to think about the whole body. I'll start with the skin, however, by noting that the drugs, both the targeted therapies and the immunotherapies, can have some skin side effects. So the targeted therapies have been associated with sort of an acne-like rash to some degree, as well as the ability to have sort of a very easy ability to burn, such that when you're taking the targeted therapies, it's really essential that you practice very safe skin approaches, like wearing long sleeves and wearing protective sunblock. It's not as bad with the two drugs together as Dr. Chaubey mentioned, but we've seen patients before who even got a sunburn just walking to their mailbox to get their mail. So it really is important that patients wear a hat and they wear sunblock and so on and so forth. On the immunotherapy side, we see a different form of skin sort of issues, and that is that it's fairly common that patients will get a rash. It's highly variable how much of a rash that patients will get, and in reality, that rash is very much like your baby's rash because it's an immune rash, right? So we're stimulating the immune response and you get this rash. Usually, we can manage it pretty well with over-the-counter sort of topical emollients, and so like Eucerin cream from CVS is the one I often tell my patients, and just to put it on a lot. And I sometimes make a joke that if you call me, I'm just going to say more cream, more cream, more cream. And that's really the essential sort of approach, because if you get the rash, it tends to be very itchy. It's generally speaking not dangerous, but if you get it, you usually should inform your providers. Beyond that, in terms of caring for yourself, it's important to sort of have a good sense of what's normal for you, so that if it starts to change, that you're aware then of symptoms that might be different than what you're normally used to. So with targeted therapies, the drugs, as was mentioned, are generally speaking very well tolerated. It's fairly rare that patients have a problem. But with one of the drugs called dabrafenib, the BRAF inhibitor, we can sometimes see that patients will have fevers or sort of a sense of feeling unwell, sort of fevers, chills, et cetera, in that regard. And it's really important that patients communicate those symptoms to the physician or to the provider, because usually we can just take a break from treatment and those will get better. But the longer that you take the drugs in that situation, the more difficult it becomes to actually control the symptoms. So really clear communication with the healthcare team is really important in that regard. Similarly, on the immunotherapy side of things, generally speaking, these drugs are very well tolerated, meaning that the drug itself isn't what's causing the side effects, but rather if we stimulate the immune system too much, we could get immune problems. And so I sometimes tell patients that that's like lupus or rheumatoid arthritis and sort of things like that. Those sound quite extreme, and usually it doesn't come to it. But the times we get into trouble are when patients and families don't communicate what is actually going on on a momentary basis with the healthcare team, such that we sort of miss it until it gets too bad. So we can really generate any kind of inflammation in the body with these immune therapies or autoimmune-like consequences. The one that's been heard about the most is really a diarrhea syndrome. It's sort of like Crohn's disease. One thing I tell the patients is that generally speaking, this is not a linear phenomenon. So people are used to having a small headache, so taking one Tylenol, and for a bad headache, taking two. That's not how these immune therapies, generally speaking, work. It's literally the case that you'd be completely fine, and then all of a sudden the next day have 12 bowel movements with diarrhea. So that's not usually so subtle, and usually people pick that up, but it just points out that communication to the healthcare team is important, because we can treat that fairly easily in terms of giving steroids to try to block that to get the symptoms back under control. And really importantly, we've learned through many, many patients being treated now that if you get side effects and we have to stop the treatment, it does not mean that the treatment won't work. In fact, it might be the reverse to some degree, because getting the side effects may be a suggestion that there's some immune sort of potentiation taking place. And just to wrap up, then, I want to sort of emphasize that quality of life in the context of these treatments is really now a major element of how we think about the treatment. So really gone are the days of high doses of chemotherapy and nausea, et cetera, et cetera. And it's really amazing for me. I trained and became into the melanoma field just as all of this was starting to happen, when we were still really doing these high doses of chemotherapy and other things. And it's changed from patients being in the hospital and being very sick to the point where now patients are complaining about having to even come to the office even once a month to get the treatment and otherwise feeling well. And that's a good thing. And that makes us happy as physicians. But it does, again, highlight that you want to have good communication with your team. With these drugs, they're generally speaking very well tolerated. So there's no need for you to be at home really having a tough time. If you let the healthcare team know, they should be able to modify the doses, take breaks, et cetera, to really optimize that. And that's the sort of symptomatic piece of it. The final piece would be really the emotional and the intellectual piece of this. And this is a hard one because as doctors, we really don't have a prescription we can give people to say, hey, just feel better about the fact that you're dealing with cancer. But in reality, what I try to help people by saying is, well, we have a good plan and we have a good track record that these drugs can be very effective. And as Dr. Taube mentioned, we have many of them now to try. So any one of them might not get the job done, but we have many different versions of this. And we're very excited as melanoma oncologists that we think that many, if not most of our patients, we should be able to mix and match these drugs and do very, very well for them out over long periods of time. So I'll finish up by saying that this is a very exciting time to be a melanoma oncologist. It's obviously never an exciting time to be a melanoma patient. That being said, I think that outside, beyond any other cancer type, maybe the most hope is now in melanoma, that we have learned and will continue to learn and be able to develop new drugs to really help people out into the future. So thank you very much.
Oh, well, thank you very much, Dr. Luz. That was really amazing, wonderfully, wonderful presentation, and also very inspiring and exciting for people to hear of all of the treatments available that both you and Dr. Taube have identified for them to be aware of. It's really, really quite a dramatic change in the treatment of metastatic melanoma that's happened over these years, and it's quite, and I think, as you say, this is an area that has tremendous work going on, and so we do appreciate that, and thank you, and I know there'll be specific questions also for you about all the advances and how they apply to people's own treatment. Before we take questions, I just want to say a few words about the psychosocial services that you can access from Cancer Care. Cancer Care provides free emotional and social and practical and financial assistance to people living with all cancers, including metastatic melanoma. And we have a staff of oncology social workers who are all master's level trained social workers and also with expertise in working with people living and dealing with, and their families living and dealing with cancer and metastatic melanoma. And the services include both just practical and financial assistance, which helps people tremendously. So help with transportation to treatment, help with home care, child care, pain medication, all of those things that really can make such a difference, and just your out-of-pocket expenses that you're having to deal with all the time. We also do help people to practically find resources within the communities. Often people struggle to find who can help me where I live, what can I do. We're talking about both a national and an international audience here, so we do have all of those resources available. But in addition, we do offer a chance to talk with someone about your concerns or questions, and we call that counseling. And it's a chance to talk to somebody who's especially trained to listen to you and to kind of pay attention to your concerns and to try to help you. And we do that both with individual counseling. We do that on the telephone or online. We also do it in support groups on the telephone and online as well. And we have a great, I have to say, an increase in the number of online support groups that we offer. I think we offer now over 130 different types of online support groups and many, many telephone support groups. And for those of you who live within the region that Cancer Care offices are located, we also do see people in our offices in the tri-state New York area. But for the majority of you, you're actually getting your services through our helpline, which is 1-800-813-4673, which means at the end of today's call, if you have concerns or questions, you can go ahead and call that line. That's a wonderful resource for all of you to use. Or you can visit our website at www.cancercare.org. You can post a question, which then one of our oncology social workers will follow up with you on, and we'll actually work with you either in online counseling or offer you support groups or help you with the practical concerns you may have. So I think I would suggest that you just, and I have to say there are many cancer organizations, many are listed, you'll be getting those resources, of course, at the end of the program. So we're not the only organization that's out there to help you, but most importantly, we don't want anyone to think that you're alone. We want you to know that there are many places that can help you, and since we're talking to you today, you certainly can give us a try and call us and take advantage of these services. With all that being said, now we have time for questions, and we have actually a lot of time for questions. And it's really a credit to our speakers that we do have time for questions. So I'm going to ask Candace to bring all of our speakers on board, and we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. If we don't get to your question, then, of course, I will give you at the very end how to get your questions answered. But we have questions coming in right now, but I want Candace to explain to all of you how to queue up for questions and, of course, bring our speakers on board as well. Okay. Candace?
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question at this time, please press star, then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Again, to ask a question, you may press star one.
So we have a question from one of our online participants. And the question I'm going to ask Dr. Tabi, if you could address this question. Can recurrence happen at the original site of the melanoma? So if you could address that, Dr. Tabi.
Yes, thank you for asking this question. So that as unfortunately, it's a great question, but as most questions, I'm going to say it depends. So if it's if the primary melanoma was a primary skin melanoma and was treated with an appropriate wide excision, the rates of local recurrence tend to be relatively low. However, as we know, there are other surgical procedures that have been performed on patients with melanoma that may not have obtained the margins that we normally look for, which are usually about 2 centimeters for a intermediate to thick melanoma. And in case that the resection was smaller than 2 centimeters, then the risk of recurrence can be a little higher for local recurrences. The reason I said it depends is because sometimes, as I had initially discussed, melanoma can be detected as a skin metastasis. So it could be on the skin, or more specifically under the skin, and can be taken from that area, but could represent, you know, the first sign of metastatic disease. In those cases, the risk of local recurrence could be slightly higher. And of course, it comes back to the fact that if the metastatic disease is under good control with these systemic agents we've been talking about, you know, the targeted therapy, the immunotherapy, then that should prevent that recurrence.
Excellent. Thank you. And Dr. Luke, did you want to add to that?
I don't have a lot to add other than to just sort of emphasize that the appropriate screening, biopsy, and resection of melanoma in the primary setting is a whole other important sort of side of things. We're talking about treatment after melanoma has come back today, but obviously, you know, the holy grail is to have never had it in the first place. And so I will just point out that I think that there are these putative A, B, C, D, E's out there in terms of assessing for melanoma. But the most important is if you think there's any lesion on your skin that's looking abnormal or changing, you really should get that checked out. And you really should see a surgeon who has some, if it turns out it's a melanoma, see a surgeon who has experience in doing melanoma surgery to make sure it's really performed properly to avoid this problem of it possibly coming back.
That's excellent. Thank you. Thank you both. And we have another question from our online participants. And this I'm going to ask if Dr. Luke would start with this question. But this actually could be its own workshop, frankly. So we may spend a bit of time with this question. But what should I do to be ready for treatment? And again, this is a general question. So, of course, people are getting different treatments. But the concept of what should I do to be ready or to get ready to prepare myself for treatment. So,
sure.
Dr. Luke, if you could start with that question. It's a great question.
It's a great question.
Again, it could take a long time to address it. But yes.
Well, you know, so what I tell people in this situation is really to try to focus on the things that you know are healthy anyway. So there's a lot out there about that supposedly is going to help, you know, your cancer treatment work better. And unfortunately, almost entirely, none of that is really proven very well. I mean, what we know is that people who are doing well do well. So you want to get your body and your mind into a place where you're in the best position you can be. So, you know, eat well. There isn't particularly an exact diet that you have to go on, but rather, you know, you want to make sure that you're getting all your fruits and vegetables, you're limiting, you know, major amounts of red meat, so on and so forth, to be in a good spot, to get your exercise, so your body's strong. One thing we talk about is that those side effects tend to be better with these new treatments. You know, if you get sick from it, then obviously you want your body to be as strong as it can be so you can get better as fast as possible. And then the final piece that I mentioned, but I really can't stress enough, is finding a way to have to be in a good mental place. I haven't had to go through this personally, but obviously we see patients all the time, and can't imagine how difficult it is for people to wrap their minds around. So finding a way to find support, to realize that it's not a failure to ask for help and to recognize this as a major element of your treatment. And if you think about it just like a prescription, I sometimes do give the prescription to my patients, which is, you know, take some time and think about what's important and how you're going to get to a good place with this, because really if you're not in a good place mentally, it's very difficult to be in a good place physically.
Awesome. Thank you. And Dr. Tabi, did you want to also add some concepts of how to really get prepared for treatment? And,
yes, I think Dr. Luke did a great job kind of framing this, and I completely would agree with him. I would reiterate some of what he said, specifically the fact that we know that, generally speaking, patients that are in a better, what we call in medical oncology jargon, performance status, but that really refers to their ability to be active and being able to take care of their activities of daily living, tend to actually do better with the side effects of therapy as well. So clearly when you're faced with this difficult diagnosis such as metastatic melanoma, one can, you know, may tend to feel down and less interested in doing certain things. My recommendation would be, on the contrary, to try to be as active as you can possibly be, because that actually will help you with your side effects. But also, what's really most relevant, honestly, is that as you're getting treated, it's very important to be fully aware of the spectrum of the side effects that will develop, and to be very communicative with your care team, your provider, their clinic staff. Because what happens in these situations is, you know, for instance, for the single agent anti-PD-1 antibodies like pembrolizumab or nivolumab, the side effects that are severe happen in only about 10% of patients. So there could be 90% that could do just very well without any issues. And obviously for those patients, it's you know, those side effects may mean very little. But for those 10% that may, 9 or 10% that may have these symptoms, being able to communicate early, as soon as those symptoms start developing, actually will put you and your provider in the best position to be able to handle them before they develop into becoming serious.
Excellent. And, so we definitely encourage people to really work with their healthcare team, really very much, and a multidisciplinary team. I know if you want to say something about that, Dr. Tabi, all the members of the team that can potentially be at people's disposal to some extent. People often think that they don't realize the whole cadre of people that they can see when they come to a cancer center. Do you want to say something about that?
Absolutely. That's a great point, and that's what I was referring to when I mentioned the clinic team, because, you know, most cancer centers, and whether they're large academic centers or even local, you know, regional centers, they usually have nurses and physician assistants or advanced practice providers that are well-trained in oncology, that understand these side effects, that may have the full knowledge of, you know, how to deal with those side effects as they develop. We have a very sophisticated system of trying to really understand when to apply things like topical steroids versus pills that are steroids. And they're all based on really a good assessment of what the spectrum of the toxicity is. So being able to connect with a clinic nurse, with the, you know, the allied health professionals that are part of your provider's team is very, very important. Most of the times those teams are kind of structured in a way that more severe toxicities are escalated to your physician provider to make sure that they opine at the time of, you know, significant interventions like steroids. But, you know, again, there's an entire support team that's usually around every practice that delivers these medicines.
Excellent. Thank you. And we now have another question, which actually from one of our online participants, which is really a question that comes up in many of our calls, and that is that, so if I have metastatic melanoma, should my family also be checked by a doctor? So, Dr. Tabi, could you address the genetics of melanoma and what that actually means, whether heritable or somatic changes, and actually and just what that means for family members or people who are living with metastatic melanoma who worry about their family or children, others?
Sure, absolutely. Well, you know, in general, you should know that, you know, melanoma is unfortunately becoming fairly prevalent. You know, and the presence of a family member with melanoma may slightly increase the individual's risk of developing melanoma, but you should know that there's a very small percentage of patients that have what's called familial melanoma, and that's about, you know, 10%, sometimes in kind of almost, in my opinion, somewhat overestimates that there could be up to 15% of those patients that may have a specific mutation or germline mutation, and specifically in a gene called P16 that may actually increase the risk of their family having having melanoma, not metastatic melanoma. So that's a very small proportion, and typically when you are seen by a melanoma oncologist that may suspect that issue, those things are typically tested for. When the tumor is tested for mutations, and now these mutational analyses that are more extensive than the single, say, BRAF gene, most of those actually do test for P16, or the other name for something similar to it is called CDKN2A. So those are typically tested in the tumor, and if the tumor has it, then obviously, you know, the tumor arose from that individual and that individual may have it. So those particular cases tend to be identified by their melanoma physicians and they will be informed. If you have not specifically been informed about that, or if the suspicion of familial melanoma has not come up, then most likely it's not an issue. I would bring it up with your melanoma provider just to make sure that what I just discussed has been kind of thought through and considered. But if you're not identified as a familial melanoma patient, then the risk to your family actually becomes a whole lot lower. What I usually consider as kind of the role of the individual melanoma patients and their immediate family is really to be more or less of an index case that can educate their surroundings, their extended families, neighbors, and, you know, kind of their social circle to the fact that melanoma is a preventable disease in some respects. And being able to focus on sun protection and make sure that, you know, sunscreen is applied, that people are not going to tanning beds, that people are not, you know, spending hours and days and most of their vacations on a beach getting, quote unquote, a tan is very important. So in a lot of respects, from my perspective, the important message here is that for patients with melanoma to educate people around them on how to prevent it.
Excellent. And Dr. Dr. Luke, do you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I might just add a slight variation in that we were talking earlier about the BRAF test and some of the other tests, NRAS and some of these other genes. Those are really mutations that are really specific to the cancer. So patients don't need to worry that if their tumor has one of those mutations, that might mean their family members would get melanoma. They're really not the same thing. So we have genetics in our body that are normal us, and the tumor has genetics, which is based on us, but is not necessarily the same thing. So I would reassure folks and second what was said before that the incidence or how common it is to have a familial melanoma syndrome is actually very low. Now, that being said, you know, our lifestyles do tend to cluster in our families. So it can be the case that multiple people in a family could get skin cancer, and that could be a melanoma, but that could be because they're spending too much time in the sun. And so that's an important piece to sort of try to sort of pull out of this. But generally speaking, this is not something that patients need to be overly concerned about.
Excellent. Thank you. And we have a telephone question, so that'll be our last question, our telephone question. Candace?
And our question comes from the line of Lori C. Your line is now open.
My husband in 2015 had in situ melanoma removed. In 2016, he found it in his lymph nodes and went on a clinical trial with the Pembro, has since come to distant lymph nodes and is now on the Taflunar and Mekinist combo for about 3 months now. Is there a new treatment or clinical trial that he should be looking at through someone that's experienced with the metastatic melanoma?
Well, thank you. That's an excellent question. We're going to ask Dr. Tobby if you could start with that in a general way, and then we hope you'll take that back to the treating healthcare team, just general information that might be helpful. Dr. Tobby?
Yes, thank you for your question. So I'm glad to hear that your husband participated in a clinical trial, which sounds to be in the adjuvant setting, trying to prevent cancer from coming back. And it really highlights the fact that even with these advanced therapies that are very effective, unfortunately, sometimes that does not cure everyone. You know, thankfully, I'm also happy to hear that your husband is already on a treatment with BRAF and MEK inhibitors. When you are currently on an active therapy, I think the best thing to do is at this point is to determine whether that therapy is working for you. The current standard of care is to continue on that therapy until the tumor, or if the tumor then progresses or stops responding to that treatment, then additional options can be pursued. And obviously, as I've discussed, depending on the location, depending on which cancer centers are around you, there are many, many advances that are happening right now in the setting of clinical trials, phase 1, phase 2, and phase 3 clinical trials, as you heard from Dr. Luke, that you know, may be appropriate for the patient after they progress on therapy. In terms of being currently on some of those active treatments, the question of whether at some point the patient should switch from targeted therapy to immunotherapy just so that they maintain their response is still a question that is not answered. So we still at this point take the approach of continuing the therapy that's working until it stops working, and then at that point look at the situation and decide which clinical trial option would be most appropriate. Most of the tertiary cancer centers and the cancer centers that are involved in clinical trials are already evolving studies that are specifically targeted to those patients that have received the standard of therapy and now they're progressing, so trying to reverse some of these mechanisms of resistance that arise while on treatment.
Well, thank you so much. And Dr. Luke, did you want to add to that as well?
I don't have much to say other than to reassure the caller that there are many, 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 many clinical trials that could be an option. Hopefully never will be needed, but I would definitely say that if it comes to that, they definitely should seek out sort of a broad swath of which kind of options might be available.
Excellent. And I guess we should let you know that there are many places to consider in terms of finding out information about clinical trials so that you already have participated in trials. And there is a resource that we always give out at the end of the call. And so this is really such a wonderful question, but we often recommend that people call the National Cancer Institute at 1-800-422-6237, or actually you can visit their website at www.cancer.gov. And the nice thing about their website is there's a live chat feature where you can post your question and they'll tell you all the trials that are available currently. So that might be also another resource for you to consider. And also to actually take advantage of the support services here at Cancer Care to talk with someone to kind of really explore all the options that you want to think about here, because it sounds like you've been a remarkable team, you and your husband, and you've really, as I think both our physicians have said, you already participated in trials and you've already demonstrated, man, how important that is, that the whole participation in clinical trials. So thank you for that excellent question. And with that, I want to thank our speakers. You've been extraordinary. And I want to thank our participants for asking such great questions, both on the telephone and online. And as we conclude, I had said that in case you did have questions, that I was going to lead you to a place to contact. So it would be the National Cancer Institute if you still have medical questions. But I also want to stress, of course, your healthcare team. They are, of course, critically important to go back to your questions with. But I would say also, again, to contact the National Cancer Institute at 1-800-422-6237 or visiting their website at www.cancer.gov. And for those of you who have questions that really have to do with just coping with metastatic melanoma or coping with the issues of having cancer, I would definitely recommend that you contact Cancer Care at 1-800-813-4673 or actually that you visit our website at www.cancercare.gov. I'm sorry, www.cancercare.org, and contact one of our social workers here. And we will be sending you information about that as well. And I do want to thank all of you for the excellent questions you asked. I particularly also want to stress the importance of Lori's question about really participation in clinical trials and what an enormous advantage it is to participate in those trials, what a great benefit it is to utilize them and to actually be very proactive, as it sounds like Lori and your husband, you both are, in terms of really accessing the best care possible. With that in mind, I do want to say this is there's a part three to this program. It's on May 19th, the role of immunotherapy in the treatment of melanoma. So many of you may be interested in that program. It's simply a week away, so that might be of interest to you. And we're also doing a five-part series on life with cancer. And part two is understanding the costs of care and your health care coverage. But there's lots of other parts to this, and I think that I think many of you may find it very interesting, and we'll be sending you information about that as well. So with that being said, I want to thank you all for your participation today. I want to wish you all a very fine day and look forward to your being on other calls that are coming up very soon. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes today's workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone have a great day.